Greetings to members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, the salty crew scattered across the earth, friends and students here and there, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash. I'm speaking on the evening of July 7th, Saturday evening here in Spain. I'm sitting out here on the terrace of the Turton's Observatory deck, where I watch the constellations and listening to the bird song of the evening. Soon the frogs will be croaking down in the reservoir below. The moon, of course, is up already in the waning phase of the moon. And over the last few evenings, since, say, Wednesday, I think, July 3rd or 4th, I was up at dawn to watch the alignment, the exact rectilinear alignment of the star Aldebaran in the eye of the bull, with Jupiter above it, with Venus aligned above Jupiter, and above Venus, the Pleiades, the so-called omen of deliverance. What I want to say in this briefing, first of all, is thank you for your concerns about me and for your superhuman patience. Had things been progressing in other ways in my life and in the correction event itself, I might have been providing you with more frequent briefings, one or two a week. This is, after all, the critical turning point in the correction process. You want to know what's going on. You want to hear the nav's fix on events, the interpretation of the celestial omens, and whatever reflections that I might have on the evidence of correction in personal reality and in the social and collective theater at large, of course. I created that anticipation in you when I invited you to this experiment, so why don't I answer to the anticipation that I've instilled in you? I want to thank you all for being patient with me. There's a lot of crew email I haven't responded to for a couple of months. Some I haven't even looked at yet. I won't say I've been overwhelmed. That's kind of a cliche term in planetary tantra. As I've said before, if you're not overwhelmed and you're not getting more than you can handle, then you're not really in the process. Well, this is true, as you all know, as most of you, I would say, know from first-hand experience. But I'm not going to use it as an excuse or pretext for negligence. I hope that you won't feel that I've been negligent. I don't think I have, although I have had a troubled conscience at moments about the delivery of my navigation reports. I am well. I'm doing very well. I'm in great health. There's nothing bothering me. I'm not having a mental breakdown. I'm not being attacked by archons, although I did have a couple of psychic attacks recently. By way of updating you and getting you to feel a little more comfortable with me and a little more comfortable with the silence to which I've been subjecting you, I might give you a little report on personal events. A couple of interesting things have happened quite recently. In June, 12th of June, I think it was, 11th or 12th of June, I signed a contract with an Italian publisher, Uno Editori. They're located outside Turin, Italy. Just the place where the Shroud of Turin is located, by the way. Interestingly, the Shroud of Turin, according to certain of my consultants and my informants, is an instrument of black magic, like various artifacts, relics, and ceremonial objects of black magic used by the satanically twisted Catholics. So anyway, very close to this site of black magic is the publisher that is going to bring out Not in His Image in Italian. And the publication date is November 28th, 2012. So in December of 2012, this book will be read and discussed in Italy. And there's a promotion campaign leading up to that. They're translating the book as I speak. What happened exactly at that time, the day before or after I signed the contract, I was downstairs at about 2 in the morning making a cup of tea in my kitchen. And I was standing by the stove there, and one of the little lights was on, overhead lights. It was a very typical scene. It could have been imagined many times. How many times in the middle of the night or wee hours of the morning have I stood in front of the stove waiting for the kettle to boil and fishing into a jar for a tea bag? I was doing that. The house was dark. I could see from the kitchen, past the kitchen counter, through the large metal doors that lead out onto the front terrace. This is on the ground level of my house, of course. And as the tea was, the water was getting ready to boil, I had the tea bag in my fingers, between my fingers, you know how that feels. And I kind of looked around. It was lighter outside than it was inside. This was the moment of the, getting at the moment of the hinge, by the way. The hinge of the of that Dakini shift. As the house was dark, and so, you know, it was a little lighter. I could see the grill of the iron bars on the two big doors opening to the terrace. And suddenly I realized that I wasn't actually in my kitchen making a cup of tea. I was actually in the bedroom next to the kitchen sleeping. So I had a sudden bilocation event. I realized that I was having, well, at the moment that I realized that, the dream went lucid. Obviously, this is how it happens, you know. You can be having a dream, and then at a certain moment, the dream can become lucid. Usually, it's like a switch is turned on. And so I thought, oh, well, this is why I'm dreaming of something so ordinary. This is why I'm dreaming that I'm doing something that I would normally do, because it's a moment for a lucid event. But what's the purpose of this event? And as I calculated all this in the millisecond in which all this came about in my mind, I turned slightly to my left, and looking over my left shoulder, I saw a shadow movement. I saw that one of the doors of the large grilled doors, glass-fronted doors leading to the open outer terrace, or lower terrace, was open, about a foot open. Now, I don't know how that happened. It may have been open, and I didn't notice it at first. It was standing open, and on the other side, just outside the boundary of the house, was a figure, which is like a ninja, was a ninja. You know what a ninja looks like, completely robed and masked, and crouched in this position of lethal aggression. You would probably know what that position looks like as well. The two hands are held up, one slightly ahead of the other, flat-palmed, as if they were ready to cut, and the body is crouched as if it's ready to leap, and this is a standard attack position for a ninja assassin. So, I immediately took account of the situation and calmly walked around the little bar in the kitchen and into the other room and up to the doorway and stood about 3 feet away from this figure. And we proceeded to engage in a series of lethal blows. And I was surprised at my, I was a little bit alarmed, reflecting on it later, that my response time in dispensing of this entity was about 15 seconds. It took me about 15 seconds. And after I finished, which basically left the entity in shreds, it was as if I had taken a sword and cut this, cut the robes of this ninja figure with the figure inside into ribbons, and all that was left was a pile of ribbons, a pile of black ribbons on the outer terrace, and the wind came and blew them away. And then I went back to sleep, I debilocated, or I woke up or whatever. I was reflecting on the event and thinking, been a long time since I've had anybody get that shirty around me. I'm sure this is connected with the Italian contract, no doubt. You know, it's my understanding that the Jesuits were pioneers in remote viewing, which is a technique that they stole from the Mayan Aztec shamans that they murdered. And this technology of psychic warfare used by the military, CIA experiments, Montauk, Project blah, 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 whatever they are, these remote viewing projects, were all anticipated and preceded by the Jesuits. And I think that today, it's my understanding that today, they continue to perform these experiments in a group manner. So you can imagine that somewhere in the grotty, stinking confines of the Vatican, there are dark rooms with teams of people hovered around the central figure, who is the one who is sent out, the assassin. It's an astral event. It's an astral event that borders on the physical. You know, you can wake up with scars. I have many times in the past. And also they are able in some cases to plant objects in people's houses, which people find the next day, crystals, various objects and things like this. So these are the kind of games they play. A remote viewing team at the Vatican had certainly sent this Jesuit ninja entity in my direction with the intent to strike me some kind of blow that would then have been reflected in an immediate infection of the lungs and things like that. This is the dirty, kind of dirty work that they do. That's a long, long time since I've been confronted with anything like that. So I immediately associated it with signing the Italian contract, because it's my intention. Let me declare it to you now and to the whole world who's listening, to bring the Vatican down with this book. I know the Vatican is already crumbling. There's a lot of problems with the Italian bank, the Vatican Bank. Three high-placed cardinals have been indicted for whatever, sexual misconduct. All that is a Mickey Mouse Club game compared to what I intend to do to the Vatican with this book and with the promotion of this book. So there's fun on coming on the way here, and this was not a particularly scary incident, Didn't feel any fear whatsoever in relation to this kind of entity. But I was concerned that it took me 15 seconds rather than 5. The difference between 15 seconds and 5 seconds is a lot when you're talking about this kind of psychic warfare. So the fact is, the old Nahual's a bit rusty in that respect. I better sharpen up my talents here, and since they throw any other of these disgusting astral entities in my direction. There's been a little bit of other psychic intrusion around the house, espionage and so forth, but I don't really give a shit. And I don't engage myself with those games, because they mostly are games of intimidation. And that's one thing that's been happening in the life of the Navigator that you might find interesting. Also, other developments, well, two other developments. One is, it appears that I've found a place here in Spain, quite close to me, a newly built house, actually built by the man who built the house I'm living in right now, my landlord. And I had a tour of this house a couple of weeks ago, and it looks like it could be the place for the Amergain Trust. That is to say, the place where I would store my files and archives, which are currently being held in Portugal. So, events are in motion to have my library and archives brought here and to eventually install them in this building, which would then be a place to receive groups and visitors or individual students who would come here for the purpose of using that library. And of course, I'm a stone's throw away, so it would then make it possible for meetings and collaborations, and possibly even some shamanic and telestic seances, who knows. Third development is that concerns my screenplay, Sabina, which was written 10 years ago, November of 2002. My screenplay, Sabina, based on the life of Sabina Spielrein, was the first mistress of C.G. Jung, is a great love story. And due to be turned into a film, if I have anything to say about it. Recently I read just a section, a little bit of dialogue from it, on one of the NAB briefings, and because it concerned the subject of love for humanity. You might recall that. Several of you responded, and I will say that Sabina, the entire screenplay, printed as a screenplay in the format that professionals use, with a long preface by myself and an afterword by my colleague and story editor, Madonna McManus, is going to press soon. And I'll announce when that book is available. And you can actually read the screenplay if you like. If you haven't ever read a screenplay of a film, it's a lot of fun to read a screenplay, because you can read it very quickly. It's a screenplay. One page of a screenplay corresponds to 1 minute of screen time, more or less. So this is 121 page or screenplay, which is 2 hours and 1 minute, and you can read it in an hour and a half, and it's really enjoyable because you can picture the movie as you're reading it. It's a different exercise of imagination from reading a novel. Obviously, it's much less involving and subjective, because you yourself can picture the movie as externalizing the movie from your mind as you're reading it. So I'll announce that that's available, and as a result of having read that, a few crew members wrote, and through one of the crew members who responded, I was provided with an introduction to someone who was used to be in the German film industry, and she in turn provided me with an introduction to a gentleman called Thomas Mausch, M-A-U-C-H, who is a German cinematographer. He's been around for quite a while. He used to film with Werner Herzog. And she sent a screenplay to Thomas Mausch, and he absolutely fell in love with it and is mad and crazy about it, and wants to do it. So there is one solid professional person here in Europe who I can now meet to discuss further steps to bring Sabina to the screen. He lives in Berlin, and I'm very much looking forward to going there. Because I really like Berlin. It's a city with a lot of power and energy and excitement. As far as cities go, I can stand Berlin for a few days. Parallel with that, I'm currently in discussion with a French filmmaker. She's a member of the crew. She came down to see me from southeastern France, where she lives, to discuss Sabina. She read it and said that it is an absolute masterpiece of screenwriting. And she proposed to me to work with her and form a production company. So we're forming VV Productions, which will be located in, which will be a French entity that will be able to receive funding for this film from various agencies in France and elsewhere in the European community. So those are some developments in the Turton's personal and creative life, you could say. I apologize for the sound quality here. There was a little noise from the speaker of the fan, but I can't get the Mac to record with the usual headset thing, headset setup. I don't know why. I have registered all the usual settings, and the headset's just not working. On that note, I might say that over the last 3 months, and increasingly since we're moving into pleuromic relay, I had a lot of difficulty engaging myself with electronic instruments. While I must admit that I'm grateful that I have Skype to talk to people, be in contact with the world, and grateful that I have this device I'm using right now to talk to you. I can put this recording online after I speak, put it on the internet. Anyone who wants to can listen. These are the wonders of modern technology. But I'm experiencing an increasing repulsion toward everything having to do with IT, computers, and the whole archonic system of telecommunications and information management. That's one of the factors that has played into my into the fact that I haven't been delivering to you, to the crew, as frequently or as lavishly as I might like to do. It's practically impossible for me to attach myself to a computer for 2 hours and write a set of crew notes. My apologies for saying that I would send out a compilation of confirmation and celebration. I can't do it because I can't bring myself to do what it takes of the clicking and scrolling and pasting and standing in front of the computer and finding the link to the YouTube clip on the lectures of the electric universe theory that were done at the conference in the spring and putting that, embedding that, or linking that. I can't do it. It's just, I can't. I'm just feeling tremendous repulsion. Besides, I don't want to spend that much time of what remains to me in life interacting with these machines. So this has, I'm sorry to say, been one of the factors that's impeded me from reporting to you as often as I would like. In some cases, this response that I'm feeling is almost extreme or grotesque. I'll report on this because some of you may be experiencing similar or parallel responses. I don't have a telephone. The only thing that connects me to the world is this chicken wire antenna I'm looking at right now that picks up a signal from a repeater 6 miles across the valley. I don't have a landline. I don't have a telephone. In fact, I do have a cell phone with a pay-as-you-go card. This cell phone is, without doubt, the most detested object in my personal accessories. I can barely pick it up. when I go to pick it up and hold it in my hand, it's like I'm picking up some greasy, writhing cockroach, you know? And I hate this cell phone, and I hate to talk on it. It's the conversations that I can have on it with people are so bad. They're interrupted so frequently. The quality of the signal is so bad that I just don't ever want to use it, you know, and I rarely ever do. I mean, I long for the days when I could go into a room in my house. I could throw myself into a sort of armchair. I could reach out to a table, pick up a telephone, pick up the headset, the handle of a telephone, dial a number, and sit there and have a conversation with someone. You know, in my life, I had a lot of good conversations with people on the telephone, a lot of important conversations, deep and intimate. I don't have that anymore in this electronic communication. I'm grateful that I can communicate with you, obviously. We're using this now. I'm looking very closely at what we can use as an alternative to this. I would consider it to be a really positive development if the whole field of archonic technology came down, but not such that we would lose the elementary features of communication. I would like to see us retain the elementary features of these telecommunication systems, which are simply just telephones, you know? Long-distance telephone. I can have a conversation on Skype with someone in Australia or Tahiti, but that conversation is not like talking to them, someone on the telephone in the past. It's a disembodied phantom type of conversation. I wonder, as you all do, if the IT network of telecommunications and telemetry and all the satellites that are used for surveillance and all the technology that the global psychopaths employ for their insane scheme of mind control may not come down in a heartbeat. I wonder if this may not happen. Gaia is certainly capable of doing this. If Mantis comes out, that could well be the moment when a lot of these systems get fried. But I don't necessarily want the whole system to disappear. I don't want to return to, you know, smoke signals and mirrors. It would be good if we had the IT communication system, but if we just had it in a more simple and practical mode, if it were just, you know, not so hyped and exaggerated and complicated. I mean, it's so that may happen. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I continue. It's just one more comment in this vein. These are my personal observations, which may parallel yours. I continue to feel excessive stress upon my first attention. I feel it at moments of the perigee surges, such as the recent one, which was July 1st. Today is the 7th of July. About a week ago, there's a perigee surge in 12 Sagittarius, which is at Antares in the heart of the Scorpion. That surge had a particular significance for me because my natal sun, stands in 12 degrees of Sagittarius in the heart of the Scorpion. So this unique, there's only one perigee surge at Antares during correction, and that was it. And in that perigee surge and in those preceding and those that have unfolded over the last 6 months, I feel, as perhaps you do, that there is a deep reworking and recalibrating of my first attention, but in ways that I can't really read. You know, she is working upon the first attention and recalibrating it. But it's almost impossible for us to see how she does that, because what she is doing is at a subliminal level beyond the reach of logical cognitive detection. Nevertheless, I feel the results of this, you know. It's very difficult for me to concentrate on certain things. It's not as if I'm losing my powers of concentration, which belong to the first attention. No, my powers of observation and concentration are stronger than ever, but due perhaps to the re-rifling of the first attention. I can't bring my mind to certain things, and I can't bring my mind. I have no patience for a lot of things anymore. Just have no patience. I have absolutely no patience for instance, advertising. Sometimes when I click on a YouTube clip to watch, say, a 10-minute lecture on plasma cosmology, the YouTube clip is set up in such a way that there's a band at the bottom, or that they present you with a commercial, and they give you the option to skip it in 5 seconds. I can barely wait until those 5 seconds are over. I can barely stand to watch a commercial for 5 seconds, because when I see a commercial, what I see is fake, 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 and more fake thrown into my face with this rapid editing technique that puts me into a murderous rage. I do not want to be subjected to this kind of input even for a fraction of a second. It is disgusting, it is intrusive, it is a form of aggression on my mind, and I can't take it anymore. Bear in mind that everything that is done in advertising is fake. For instance, there is a advertisement that frequently comes up with the YouTube clips in my part of the world. It's an advertisement for car insurance in Spain. And the gimmick of this advertising is it's telling you that if you're a family and there's the husband and the wife and the two kids, and so, you know, you're in the system and you need more than one car, but you can't afford more than one car, so you get a car and a motorcycle, and the insurance policy that you buy is a blanket insurance for a car and a motorcycle, and they're selling this to people. Can you actually believe that they are actually selling this to people today in Spain, when people can't even rub two crusts of bread together, when they're going to be violent, bloody red demonstrations in the street, when the young people in Spain between 15 and 35 are up to 50% unemployed. And they're peddling this. And when you see the ad, what do you see? You see a woman coming out of a house, and then her husband is standing there in the driveway. And she comes and they smile and they greet each other, and she puts the kids into the car and straps them up, and he's standing there putting on the helmet to get on his motorcycle, and then you see the kid in the strapped into the seat holding this little puppy dog, this little peluche, what do you call it, a stuffed animal, which is a symbol of the security of the child, which is a symbol of the security of the insurance. And these people are actors. The child is an actor. Everything is fake. It's all faked. And you have to ask yourself, what kind of a world do we live in where if there is anything that is worth buying with your money, that you need to be persuaded to buy it by total fakery? And in addition to this fakery, which is archontic pretending and simulation, the content is fakery. And in addition to the fake content, they deliver the fake content into your mind with this rapid editing technique and this subliminal messaging, like the little stuffed animal and the way that a certain actor is coached to smile. And they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and whole teams of people are involved in constructing this fakery to persuade the human animal to enslave itself into a system whose only purpose is to provide money, to bring money to those who are running the system. I would like to see a number of things happen in correction at the collective level. This is just my wishful thinking. It's just the NAV's wish list. One of the things I would like to see is that advertising becomes more and more unacceptable, that people just become immune to advertising, that they become disgusted by it, that they completely turn it off, that even housewives sitting at home watching reality TV shows, when the Mr. Clean, you know, Senor Limpio, whatever he's called in Spain, when the Mr. Clean advertisement comes on with the fakery of the computer-generated genie, Mr. Clean, rushing around the kitchen, and the woman actress who has been coached to smile and be surprised and have a conversation with this archontic entity, when all of that even bores the Spanish housewife so much that she looks away from it. This is what I would like to see happen in correction, that the fakery and subliminal manipulation have gone so far over the top that nobody can stand them anymore, and that advertising revenues would absolutely plunge into the pits. What is the point of advertising anyway? Nobody has any money to buy these things that they are being persuaded to buy. It's completely insane. The other thing that I would like to see, personally, as a result of correction, is I would like to see a change in the collective and social attitude such that quite ordinary people, from children up through young people and right up to the elderly, begin to look on anyone who wears a suit with contempt and suspicion. Anyone who wears a suit must be, in my mind, the object of enormous contempt and suspicion. And I would love to see the social attitude shifting in such a way that people who wear suits are disregarded and dismissed by the very fact that they're wearing suits. Why do people wear suits? Why in our society is it considered a requirement to wear a suit? And what is it about wearing a suit and a tie that is supposed to make someone have an authoritative presence, that they are taken seriously, where someone who's just wearing a shirt or a jacket and a shirt is not? So I would like to see this go down. I would like to see a lot of the telecommunication system go down. Now, this may happen due to the intense solar activity we're seeing. It's my view that these intense solar emissions, which are continuing, are working in coordination with Sophia's hits upon the first attention. I've said before that the first attention is rifled. This is a great mystery of shamanism, and something you can only really comprehend if you see it firsthand in an altered state. Seeing how the first attention is rifled, how it is lined inside with a complex network of ridges and furrows like the rifling of a gun barrel. This is one of the great, great mysteries of the construction of conscious and sentient life in the universe. The rifling of the first attention is what allows different species to follow their own particular instinctual programs. The dolphins have a rifling of their first attention that allows them to be dolphins, to behave like dolphins. the rifling of the first attention of human animals is an extremely fascinating and complex subject of shamanic investigation. And it is the rifling, when you are born as a human animal, you inherit a portion, you inherit a kind of circuit of the first attention that is provided by the universe. The power of the first attention is provided by the aeons themselves. It is the observational power of the aeons, but it is scoped and scaled down to the dimension of sentient creatures. You have, in fact, the same observing power of an aeon. You have it right now. As you listen to me speaking, as you sit there, look at your hand. Look at the palm of your hand. Turn it over and look at the top of your hand. Feel the power of your observation on the top of your hand, as if it was coming from your eyes, as if it were a light breeze that comes from your eyes and touches the top of your hand. That is the power of observation of the first attention. That allows you to observe your hand. It allows you to observe the universe. That power of observation in your first attention, operating right here, right now, is the very same as the aeons possess. The aeons observing the galactic arms from the center of this galaxy experience their power of observation just as you experience yours by looking at the back of your hand. There is no gradation in consciousness. This is one of the principles of Mayavada, Vedanta. There is no gradation in consciousness. The two other principles of Mayavada Vedanta are: everything is material. And three, matter and consciousness are both eternal. So these are the three principles of Mayavada Vedanta, which are the only metaphysical or cosmological principles that you need in Kali Yuga to understand the most intimate operations of your own mind and of the universe. Now, it might be more correct syntactically to say that there is no gradient of awareness. In fact, I would say that is the more correct syntax. There is no gradient of awareness, but there is an instrumental breakdown of consciousness. So the awareness that you have as you hear my words, listening, is the same awareness of the aeons listening to the rush of the carousel spin of the galactic arms. It's the same. But the consciousness that you have as a human animal is calibrated into a specific rifling so that you can be a human animal, so that you can be a particular entity in a particular place. And a June bug, a nematode in the earth, cockroach, a white raven, an elephant, are all provided with a specifically calibrated first attention that allows them to pay attention as the entities that they are. But the power of awareness within the attention is the same as that of the aeons. There is no gradation of awareness in the universe. But there is a calibration of the instruments of consciousness and sentient activity. What is happening with these perigee searches is that Divine Sophia is recalibrating the first attention of the Antipos 10. And this is happening to us, and it's extremely difficult to know that it's happening because we are inside the process. There is no viewpoint that you can normally have, nor I, unless I go into telestic trance. There is no viewpoint I can have on a process that I am inside of. And so this is why I haven't reported much on the perigee searches, because I don't really have much to say. Very often when they come, I'm experiencing myself as being completely overwhelmed. You may have detected now that we've lived through a year and a half of perigee surges, that there's a kind of compression. I feel like, and ask you, do you feel, as I do, that there's a kind of compression, not just on my mind and in my head, but there's a kind of a compression into my body, down into my psychosomatic instrument. And that compression is due to the intention, the divine enoya that Sophia is bringing as she scans our first attention circuits and recalibrates them. There is one piece of news I want to give you that is probably among the best news I could possibly give you, reporting as a navigator. But I think some of you may have realized this already. We are currently in the third week of Pleromic Relay. Pleromic Relay began on June 16th when Jupiter attained 1 degree of Gemini, aligned to the Pleiades. It is below the Pleiades in its actual celestial position, but its alignment is to the Pleiades. This is the plug-in of Pleromic Relay. If you want to picture Pleromic Relay in its physical reality, picture the kind of cable that's used to attach a television screen, television monitor, to a VCR. You'll find that behind the VCR or behind the television, in the panel behind it, there is like a 16 or a 21 point plug, either the male or female version. You know what this looks like. The head of this plug has 16. It has usually three layers with maybe seven or eight or whatever. Multiple point plugs in the head of this connecting cable. The relay cable from the Pleroma is the same. As it emanates from the Pleroma, the relay cable has three strands, three massive braids. One of organic light, one of superorganic light, and the third of something that I've called electrical plasma. I don't really think this is an accurate term, and I need to find a better term. But it is more or less like a copper cord, which would be the electrical plasma, as I'm calling it, interwoven with two optical fibers, one of which is pure white and one of which is pure black. So picture this triple braid, copper, white, and black, as a massive torrent proceeding from the Pleromic aeons at the galactic center. A massive braid which reaches the Pleiades. When it reaches the Pleiades, it streams through the structure of the seven component stars that mark that constellation, that mark the visible constellation. In doing so, the triple braid is amplified into 21 fibers, 3 times 7. And so when the braid comes out of the Pleromic spindle to the Earth, it has now 21 fibers, which are like the 21 points in the head of a connecting cable for a VCR. And what happened on June 16, 2012, is that this 21 point cable plugged in to the geoelectrical and bioelectrical magnetic field of the Earth, the BEMA. As a result of this, the Bima of the planet Earth is now undergoing a massive electrification process and a massive animation process proceeding from the Pleromic Aeons, and Sophia herself is responding to this. During the first 18 or 20 days when this connection was being made, an extraordinary sound was recorded on this instrument called the magnetometer, and I pointed you to that data in recent briefing that I gave. At a certain moment, that sound mysteriously stopped. The gentleman reporting on that on the YouTube site called Suspicious Observers called it the 1400 anomaly because it occurred promptly at 2 hours of 1400 p.m. Universal Time. I mistakenly had said 2 a.m. No, it was 2 p.m. 1400 hours Universal Time, and I actually sat here on the terrace not alone listening to this, so I had someone else who was listening to it with me, and you could actually hear it acoustically during this time. It sounded like very distant thunder on the horizon, but the rumbling was almost like an animal rumble, almost like a distant animal roar. And as I noted, there were two features in the anomalous data detected by the magnetometer. One of them was the roar itself, the acoustic signal of the planetary animal mother responding, calling to the aeons. And the other was the logon signal coming from the aeons. The logon signal was coming from that 21-point relay head. And we logged on during those 20 days or 24 days during which the signal was detected. I'd also point out that during those 24 days during which that signal was detected, at the rate of about 15 degrees a day, the Pleromic Aeons used the relay mechanism to scan the entire planet. They scanned the entire planet in 24 days. So this is equivalent to saying that if you plugged in a relay cable of a VCR into a monitor, that before the image appeared on the monitor from the VCR, that there would be a period of interaction in which the monitor and the VCR would talk to each other. And the monitor that is going to show what is proceeding from the VCR would scan the circuits, the 21 circuits provided by the VCR. It would scan those circuits, scan them entirely, make a summation of the information that was being transmitted, and then it would begin to reproduce that transmission on the screen. Something similar is happening here. So we can expect from around July 3rd or 4th, when the 1400 anomaly stopped, that relay enters into its second phase. And in its second phase is characterized by intense animation of the atmosphere. Now, I started to see this animation within a day that it happened. And I observed it in the dawn sky looking at the Pleromic relay. What I observed was that first, Venus rose over the western horizon, over the hills to the west, to the east of my house, excuse me, the eastern horizon. Venus arose first with the Pleiades nearby. Significantly, in the first days of the appearance of this omen, it's not possible to see the Pleiades very well because the moon is still quite bright. But the moon is waning now. Each night, or each dawn, that you observe this now, it will be darker at the moment of observation due to the waning of the moon. Therefore, the presence of the Pleiades and the position of the Pleiades in the alignment will become visually more clear. Observe this if you can. To return to my observations. I'll tell you what I saw the first two or three times that I watched this configuration rising. I saw Venus come up, and I knew the Pleiades were just above it, but I could barely see them. They were so faint. Venus rose vertically, the eastern horizon. Next rose Jupiter. Jupiter was enormous. Enormous. And I have to point out that this itself is a massive anomaly. You know, I've watched Jupiter all my life, and I've seen Jupiter be as large, look as large as a grapefruit. And that is how it looked on the morning of July 4th and July 5th. This doesn't make any sense. Astronomically, this is illogical, because Jupiter only appears to be that large when the Earth is passing Jupiter. During that time each year, when the Earth overtakes and passes Jupiter, naturally, Jupiter, which is the second of the outer planets, is close to the Earth. It's like you are driving down a freeway in your little VW bug, and you pass a great 16-wheeler off to your right. It's very close to you while you're passing it. Well, Jupiter appears enormous at that time, naturally. This is a normal phenomenon. Well, you explain to me why Jupiter appears now to be just as enormous when actually the Earth is on the other side of the Sun. You explain that to me. My impression is that the whole atmosphere of Jupiter is scintillating and throbbing and undergoing even a kind of material and luminal expansion because of the way that it is accessory to the pleuromic relay. So the first anomaly I observed is that Jupiter is gigantically huge to observation at a time when it should not be. Then Jupiter rose right below Venus, and then slightly below Jupiter, the star Antares in the eye of the bull. And at a certain moment, just before dawn, this alignment stands on the eastern horizon, and it's like perfectly vertical. And it's like a stem. It's like a stem. I can't put it in any other way. The alignment of the star, the two planets, and the open star cluster is like a stem. But the open star cluster is off to the side of that alignment. So that reminds me of a kind of, excuse me for the iconic analogy, kind of a cell phone tower. You know, cell phone tower goes straight up, and then at the top you have this cluster of instruments, and it's a little off to the side. It's not positioned exactly at the crown or apex of the vertical tower. This is exactly what the relay looks like to visual observation. Now, what I'm going to do is complete this briefing in a few minutes, sitting out here on the terrace. I'm still using the inbuilt mic, so I hope the sound quality is okay. I'm chasing away bugs from the screen. Nikki's walking around here on the terrace. It's dark now. I'm concluding this briefing, but I'd like to do a second one this evening to follow up with more navigational instructions, especially regarding the perigee surges that are ahead and the apogee surges that are ahead. But just to complete the observations I've been making, let me return to the point about the fantastically good news. Of course it's fantastically good news that pleuromic relay is operating on the planet Earth. This is completely unprecedented in the life of the planetary animal mother or in the life of our species, as far as I know. One factor in my recent reticence to report is that I can't tell you what this means. All bets are off as far as the effects of this are concerned. The effects of this bring us to the absolute limit of human imagination. And neither I nor anyone else can predict what the effects are going to be. We are all equal in this experiment, observing these effects in real time as they arise. But I have seen a scintillation of lights in the sky, like electrical points of light in the sky. And I observed that when I was looking at the Venus, Jupiter, Pleiades, Antares alignment. I noticed that there are sparkles, like sparklers, like a kind of glittering confetti. Am I detecting first signs of the pleromic electrification of the atmosphere due to relay? I don't know, but I am certainly detecting something. And I ask you to observe very closely if you can detect these scintillating or sparkling movements in the air and in the sky. They are very light. They are very subtle and very light. They remind me of a kind of glittering confetti, kind of metallic confetti that is blown through the air. I am supposing, on the basis of my knowledge of astronomy and on the basis of my understanding of correction, that this is kind of phenomena we would observe. Now, to get to the point here, that's already good news, but I have even better news. Everything that is, we are electrical animals, and life, as I told you, is defined by the aeons as the animation, the electrical animation of colloids. The electrified animation of colloids. This is how life is defined by an aeon. This is how an aeon sees life. It's how an aeon sees a human body. Do you wonder how the aeons like Christos and Telete in the pleuromic center, can they observe you and see your body? Yes, they can. They can not only observe the entire planet Earth from a distance, they can observe it in close focus. They look at the planet Earth the way that a scientist would look at a plasm in a Petri dish through a high-powered microscope. You know what those microscopes look like with the different settings, and you see the scientist looking into the eyepiece of the microscope and adopting the setting or adjusting the setting, twisting the lens. They can twist the lens of their first attention in such a manner that they can observe the Earth in its entirety. They can come in and they can observe it at a surface level, second magnification, and they can come in and observe it at the level of the animation of sentient creatures, third magnification, and they can observe it at the molecular level, fourth magnification, if you will. And what do they see? They see the electrified animation of colloids. And so the human animal, and we are animals, no more talk of human beings. The collection of human animals on this planet, the totality of human animals, are being massively stimulated and mutated by pleuromic relay. Insofar as we are creatures composed of electrified colloids, then the way that we behave and the way that we are constructed organically is undergoing intense mutation as correction advances, and nobody can follow that cohesively or comprehensively. Nobody. All we can do is have glimpses of it, as I do, and as you do as well. So please continue to report to me your personal observations of yourself and the world around you. And although I don't respond always, because I can't stand to be writing emails on the internet, I do not let anything you send me go unobserved. You can trust me on that. I do not dismiss anything. I do not disregard anything. I look at everything you tell me. Now, I just want to say that in conclusion, the conditions of pleuromic electrification of the atmosphere allow Sophia to work intimately upon the first attention and to work intimately into the realm of animal magnetism. Thank you, Anton Bessmer. She is mutating the human species at the level of animal magnetism. And the really fantastic news about this is that due to the anomaly that she has suffered until now, she can recalibrate the anthropos by direct contact. We understand from Sophia's story, we understand from following the Sophianic vision story, that the planetary animal mother was subjected from the beginning of this experiment to a number of anomalous conditions. And to a large extent, these anomalous conditions, the presence of the eons, the presence of Mantis as the materialized animation of her terror and separation, the oblivion and break of continuity with the aeons, the break of continuity with aeonic consciousness, the oblivion of being absorbed into the planetary elements, the artistic preoccupation of her intelligence to maintain the imminent life of the planet, not allowing her to achieve full pronoia or full direction of her own faculties. All of these things are enormous conditions which disadvantage and handicap her immensely, if you will. She has been immensely preoccupied and handicapped by the multitasking process of maintaining this planet. But now, in pleuromic relay, in this critical moment of correction, she comes to a point of advantage that she could not have had she not been subjected to those disadvantages. Were she not intimately present as the body of the Earth, with intimate access to human-animal magnetism, she could not recalibrate Anthropos 10. That can an Anthropos or any sentient experiment, once it is calibrated in the pleuromic center, cannot be recalibrated in progress. Once the experiment is in progress, the initial calibration cannot be altered. But in our case, now, right now, it can and is being altered. And those members of the human species, those human animals who select themselves into her experiment, are offering themselves to be recalibrated through her hits on the first attention, the divine alchemy. And the supreme moment of this recalibration is September 19th, 2012, when there is a perigee hit in 8 degrees of Scorpio. And I'd like to begin the follow-up to this 1 hour and 8 minute talk by picking up on the significance of that perigee hit. So I conclude by sharing with you the fantastic news that Sophia, as she integrates herself into pleuromic relay over the next 2 months, gains day by day and hour by hour the capacity to interact with each one of us the way that you would interact with an individual cell in your body, with a liver cell or a heart cell or a skin cell or a cell in the retina of your eye. Imagine if you could do that. And that she is able to massively and comprehensively recalibrate our sevenfold endowment, including the critical factor of perinoia, which is the factor that causes the experiment to go wrong because we have too strong a dose of perinoia. and when it goes out of proportion to our relationship to the external environment, we fall into the trap of pretending. And this is where we lose it. And that pretending combines with phobia. We turn against the very environment that supports us. So this is the crux of correction. This is the crux of the high planetary magic in which you are involved. And this is the moment to contemplate it. But keep your mind open, because I tell you, I haven't been reporting because honestly, I don't know what to say. I can brief you on the syntax over and over again, but I cannot predict how this is going to play out. This is the great adventure. This is pure and total cosmic novelty.